Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on our show, we'll hear what's driving a mason jar trend, and it isn't all home canning. Restaurants in places like D.C. are serving drinks in them.
We think that here just kind of goes with our theme of home and comfort food, chicken, fried chicken and donuts, so I think a mason jar just kind of brings it back to that coming from grandma kind of feel, straight Americana.
And we'll explore why Jell-O was so important to women in rural Appalachia in the 1950s.
Jell-O had been around since the early part of the 1900s in the cities, but they had methods of getting ice or electricity to put the refrigerator and put the Jell-O in the refrigerator. So it was sort of like this, oh, now we're modern. Now we have electricity. Now we have a freezer. Now we have ice. Now we can make these Jell-O recipes.
You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia.
Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, bringing food from your local neighborhood farmer to you at West Virginia Farmers Markets. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today we're going to listen to stories about two things that are on many back decks and family reunions during the hot summer months: Jell-O and mason jars. The stories originally aired two summers ago in 2016, and they come to us thanks to a show called Gravy. We'll begin by hearing about a little-known history of mason jars. Yeah, you know the ones that have a reputation for holding some of that white lightning they call moonshine. These were the jars that your grandparents probably used to preserve food that often ended up in the cupboard with the rest of the drinking glasses. Gabe Bullard takes on the cultural politics of the mason jar and why it started to become hip in recent years.
Not long after we moved to Washington, D.C. this summer, my wife and I were out exploring, and we were lured into a restaurant that offered a winning combination of fried foods.
Chicken and donuts.
It was hot, so we ordered a couple drinks.
Cheers.
Cheers.
It's a jar of tequila.
Our drinks came in mason jars, the tall, narrow, quilted pattern kind my mom back in Illinois puts homemade jam in. The manager, Fritz Wood, had a mom who did that too.
My parents were picklers, yes. Before pickling was cool. But yes, I've always had mason jars in the house and would get jam for Christmas, which now I'd probably appreciate, but you know, back then it was jam and socks and no one likes that.
I didn't ask, but it's a safe bet the jar my drink came in never held jam or pickles. Wood is upfront about using jars in the restaurant. The menu even lists punch as coming in a jar.
We think that here just kind of goes with our theme of home and comfort food, chicken, fried chicken and donuts, so I think a mason jar just kind of brings it back to that coming from grandma kind of feel, straight Americana.
The decor in the restaurant felt familiar. There were old-timey Edison light bulbs above the bar, the fried chicken was served in wire baskets, and the wood plank furniture matched the exposed brick walls. It felt like restaurants I ate at when I lived in Louisville, Kentucky. But the places it reminded me of were new too. They were designed to look old, designed to look more rural, more country than the city ever was. And as I finished my drink and watched the ice clink to the bottom of the jar, I wondered, did a place like this ever really exist in the past? I'm sure that using mason jars as drinking glasses isn't new. People have probably been doing it as long as they've been using the jars for canning, which is to say, since 1858. That's when John Landis Mason invented the now standard design. This made preserving foods at home a lot easier. And it's hard sometimes to imagine how important that was. For people who relied on food they grew, finding a way to make fruits and vegetables last through winter was a key to survival. A cupboard full of jars was an insurance policy. And when those jars are empty, well, why not drink out of them? It's just so convenient. The jars are thick, tough, and in a canner's kitchen, right there. But in the old days modern restaurants hearkened to, would anyone ever have served a drink in one? My family always had jars around, but when guests came over, the good glasses came out. Jars felt a little cornpone, a little cheap. But now, jars are being sold not only as upscale glassware, but as decor. And not just for restaurants. Visit a houseware store, or just look on Pinterest or Etsy. You'll see
mason jar vases,
mason jar planters,
mason jar sconces,
snow globes,
soap dispensers,
mason jar lamps, mason jar picture frames,
mason jar chandeliers,
mason jar silverware holders,
and of course, mugs and cups. One Pinterest user has instructions for engraving jars to say, "I'm so fancy." It's hard to imagine anyone who uses it as a serious home canner concerned with survival. So if they're not left over from canning, where are all these non-canonical jars coming from?
Sure. My name is Janine Moore, and I'm the Senior Brand Manager of Fresh Preserving at Jarden Home Brands.
Jarden is a jar-making giant. The company sells jars under the names Golden Harvest, Kerr, and Ball. A quick word on the nomenclature here. You may be thinking, hey, what you call mason jars, I call ball jars. That's fine. We're talking about the same thing. We just differ on eponyms. The Ball brothers began making what they once called fruit jars in 1884. Now back to Janine Moore.
In 2014, we produced enough ball jars to be able to circle the entire planet.
Jarden doesn't release exact sales figures, but there are some general trends they'll divulge. For instance, this equator of jars has been expanding. Moore says sales dropped off after World War II. This was in the age of better living through technology, with TV dinners, gelatin salads with shrimp in them, and fantasies of food in a pill. According to the University of Georgia, in 1944, about 70% of American households were canning fruit or vegetables. That dropped to about 30% in 1976 and stayed there until the early 2000s. There aren't recent numbers on home canning, but Jarden sales have been up in the last decade. There also isn't a reliable survey on why people are canning at home, but Moore believes home canners are rejecting the very things that led to the post-war drop.
Really, in the last 4 or 5 years, seen a huge resurgence in this canning behavior, and a lot of people really interested in what we call DIY foods, the do-it-yourself kind of spirit. They're interested in the flavors that preserving your own foods can give. They were interested in the control and knowing what goes into the foods that you eat.
Home canning's current renaissance does coincide with a greater general interest in food, health, and just understanding more about the things we consume. This explains part of the reasoning behind jars as glassware. Jarden's jars are all made in America, and for the quality, they're cheap. Back at the restaurant, Fritz Wood told me the finances behind the aesthetics are a welcome benefit. Jars are less expensive, more durable, and easier to replace than a lot of glassware. All these benefits are byproducts of the jar's original purpose. When you can to survive, there's no time for jars that aren't reusable and inexpensive. As long as the glass is intact, a canning jar can be reused indefinitely with new lids. Like knitting, raising chickens, or so many other hip DIY activities, canning is more hobby than necessity now. And Jarden tries to appeal to the hobbyist by making jars that are a bit less utilitarian.
And so now we have a whole line of beautiful quilted crystal jelly jars. And the thing that we've really seen take off in the last 3 years has been our heritage collection. So we've been able to launch jars that were blue in the first year, 2 years ago, and then green last year, and this year is the purple mason jar.
In the old days of jar making, changes in the sand used to make the glass led to a blue tint to jars. Blue jars are sought after by collectors. Moore says the Heritage Collection pays tribute to that. But as any observant restaurant goer or millennial would know, not all of Jarden's jars are used for canning.
About 30% of our sales go to things like crafting or decor or decorations at wedding or baby showers as well.
So if you take all the ball jars made last year and do as Moore says and line them up until they circle the globe, all the jars over the Atlantic are going to restaurants and Pinterest projects, not preservation. And Jarden encourages this. They make straws and sipping tops for jars. They cultivate a lively collection of non-standard uses on their Pinterest page. They even make jars that aren't suitable for canning at all, with handles and a different type of glass. But while not all jars can be used for canning, all of them are good for drinking. A few weeks ago, I was at my local farmers market in the Mount Pleasant neighborhood. It was the typical urban farm scene. Kale was plentiful, breads were artisanal, and a string band played bluegrass standards while kids danced, eating locally made popsicles. While sampling a new type of duck sausage, I stood in line with one of the young professionals who increasingly seemed to be moving into this neighborhood, and I noticed she was holding something interesting.
And so, what are you carrying today?
I am carrying a Made in the USA ball mason jar in this great little Gotham textile leather sleeve.
The woman, named Sarah Lewis, had her iced coffee in a leather-wrapped mason jar with a lid meant for sipping. She says she does use jars for canning, and she has some specialty jars, like the blue ones and jewel-cut ones. She also has some jars that aren't for canning.
We have a ginormous one that has the pour spigot in it we use for infusing bourbon, so, you know, make it sound even more like a Pinterest asshole. But,
Ball doesn't sell a jar with a pour spigot, so Lewis's infuser likely came from another company. With the patent expired, anyone can use the mason jar design. And they do. Last year, 7-Eleven sold plastic mason jars as Slurpee cups. Mason jars with wine glass stems started appearing in stores a few years ago. And Aladdin, a company I remember for making the lunchboxes and thermoses I used as a kid, sells insulated plastic jars. It's safe to say you shouldn't can in any of these. They're strictly for consumption, and conspicuous consumption at that. 7-Eleven sold their jars with ironic hipster mustache straws. The stem jars are branded as, and I quote, redneck wine glasses. And Aladdin's plastic jars are part of a collection it calls Newstalgia. There's even a matching hashtag. With so many takeoffs and imitations, the mason jar is having a bit of an identity crisis. Both DIY-inspired millennials and doomsday preppers are big fans of the classic jar used for canning. Come lately, trendsters might want 7-Eleven cups. And the same company that makes redneck wine glasses makes mason jar soap dispensers, which are also a popular DIY project for fancy Pinterest folks, who you can't imagine ever proudly calling themselves rednecks, even ironically after a few mason jar margaritas. Though she facetiously calls herself a Pinterest asshole, Lewis calls all this kitsch.
It kind of smacks as a little bit classist when you see a bunch of upper middle class suburbanites and urbanites, you know, like playing tourists in rural American culture.
Seeking jars for their aesthetics and history is an old hobby. My dad has told me he used to hunt down old jars in the 60s and 70s and sell them to collectors. These collectors had their own magazines. Some still do. Old jars are Americana antiques. Having them on a shelf displays industrial ingenuity and reminds us of a past we don't have to live through anymore. But these new plastic jars trade on that authenticity. Whether for laughs or for a shortcut to something more real, these products take something useful and resell it as an idea only. Drinking from a jar says something. It might say, I make pickles at home. I don't have any clean glasses. Or even, I want a durable container that's made in America. And drinking from a replica of a mason jar says something too. It says, I'm nostalgic. Or rather, newstalgic. But what are jar drinkers newstalgic for? Apple butter that tastes better? Gathering so carefree and casual that it doesn't matter if you use the good glassware? How do you separate that from days when the crop might not last through winter? From days when selling homemade jam was a necessary source of income? If the resurgence of canning is tied to the rising interest in better-made food, then using mason jars for drinking in public is sort of like Instagram food porn. It's born of the same trend, but more about showing off taste than cultivating it. Drinking from a jar shouts a message loud and clear, but it whispers something too.
Again, that was Gabe Bullard reporting on the increasing popularity of mason jars in restaurants and bars in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country. While the rest of the world is getting trendy with their manufactured mason jars and fancy cuisines, I do it mostly to remember my family. But these days, it's not the admitted deliciousness of RC Cola that I drink, but rather a kale and fruit smoothie in the morning. And I think that says, I'm evolving but still staying true to my roots. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear a story about how a high-profile mason jar inspired a Twitter feud.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu. Inside Appalachia is supported in part by the West Virginia Food and Farm Coalition, helping West Virginia farmers markets provide food harvested that morning and brought to you fresh from the farm. Local market locations available at farmfreshwv.com.
Thanks for listening to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We're listening to an episode of a podcast called Gravy. Let's pick back up with reporter Gabe Bullard to find out more about the mason jar.
Just like drinking out of jars isn't new, complaining about drinking out of jars has a proud, growing tradition. Cracks about authenticity-seeking jar toters have shown up on Gawker, The Onion, and the pages of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. In late December 2012, food critic John Kessler, who was then writing for the paper, went to a restaurant where the waitress served him water in a jar, which she poured out of a larger jar.
You know, she had long fingers, but they were barely fitting around the jar, and I could see her sort of biting her lip and concentrating and, like, willing herself not to drop it on me as she poured the water. And I just started thinking about, like, I don't like drinking out of mason jars. All the cocktails came in them, and I put out a tweet later on that day saying, if, you know, I never get another cocktail served in a mason jar, that would be fine. And immediately, Hugh Atchison responded.
Atchison is a chef and restaurateur in Georgia, and an active tweeter.
I can't remember what he said, but I think he said I was like a crotchety old man or something.
And so I called it, yeah, crotchety old man speak, and it quickly spiraled down the rabbit hole from there.
That's Hugh Atchison.
Something very pointed. He likes to stir up trouble on Twitter. You know, he's a tweeter.
It sounded grumpy. It sounded like somebody was, you know, I'm tired of rectangle plates.
You know, I got kind of exasperated with him and perhaps got a little pedantic in my response.
And John had to use a word, and the whole back and forth, though, is beyond anybody's understanding of words, which was, what was the word? It was metonymy.
Metonymy is when an attribute is used as a name, like calling the Queen of England the Crown or the U.S. government the White House.
So he called me out for being pedantic and, you know.
So he used that and I called him a pedant. And then he concluded the conversation with saying, I'm done with this. Chill out and stop calling people names.
The exchange gained attention in food circles, and Kessler wrote about it in his column. He had touched a nerve.
All of a sudden, like, people I didn't know were, like, tweeting to me either, you know, pro or con mason jars.
They sent him links to things like mason jar measuring cups and baby bottles.
Ha ha ha, I bet you would really want this, you know, mason jar cocktail shaker. And so I just think it became such a kind of a meme almost.
The kind of people who follow disputes between food writers and chefs in Georgia were sick of all the mason jar merchandise. And of these Pinterest assholes, to borrow Sarah Lewis's term, pretending to be rustic or authentic. But they didn't start it. Kessler's admitted pedantry was accurate. The mason jar is a metonym, It now represents a certain type of Southern restaurant.
I think that was very key to the personality of a lot of influential Southern restaurants from 4, 5, 6 years ago. There were the Mason Jars, you know, sort of blackboard shout out to the farmers somewhere in the restaurant, you know, that kind of country meets industrial design element.
And from there, the idea of Southernness, now fancified, was put in a jar and sealed. The contained became the container. And in this case, it was an actual container. Kessler compares it to pimento cheese, a simple dish, unpretentious, easy. But once it was discovered by wider audiences, it went from basic cheddar and off-the-shelf mayonnaise into a fine artisanal product. And it started showing up in everything until it became cliché.
You know, I live right around the corner from a bakery that has a pimento cheese croissant. I remember at first it was like, oh my God, this is brilliant. I love it. And, you know, I remember the last time I got one.
To Atchison, though, signifiers like fancy pimento cheese or mason jars aren't that significant.
If anything, it's a red herring.
Atchison argues that the jar is a distraction. It's superficial, like the food it's now associated with.
And we've got plenty of things to pay attention to that are real issues in the restaurant world. And I honestly don't think serving something in a mason jar is one of those issues.
The mason jar could be seen as either a hapless victim of modern hipness or a bit of flotsam in the wake of cultural appropriation. It's been around Southern food all along. First, people ate out of the jar at home. Then it was spotted in corn pone, pre-civil rights, Southern-themed restaurants. It survived to be a staple of hip restaurants, and now it's back to the recycling bin of cool culture. Through this all, it's been a signifier. First of survival, then of Southernness, then of a cool type of Southernness, now as an uncool type. So maybe it's not right then to ascribe a characteristic to anyone using a jar. Maybe not everyone is trying to send a message. Maybe they have a private memory. Maybe they don't want to say anything at all. There might be a lot of weight on what the mason jar does or does not represent, but does that mean everyone has to carry it? I asked Atchison what the modern mason jar says.
I think I'm saying that it doesn't really say that much. My argument would be that it's not really a stance, that it's not really trying to evoke a certain mindset or anything. I'm saying that it's a vessel, and it's screaming, I contain liquid or substance. Consume me?
Anyone can pour whiskey into a piece from the Ball Heritage Collection, and anyone can claim that the jar makes it authentic. But for Atchison, who uses jars in one of his restaurants, it's not what you use to indicate authenticity, it's what you're presenting when you say something is authentically Southern.
I think that we need to be really careful how we parse that sentence and how we seek to define the Southern food that at least I'm interested in purporting to be awesome and really interesting. And that to me is a real true celebration of the cultures, the vast amounts of cultures that brought us the food of the agrarian South. And it's a coming to terms with a lot of lies about what the new South means. And it's about coming to terms with this false pretense that Southern food is, you know, crap stuck between two donuts and sold, you know, as Southern woohoo, look at me. Food, you know, it's not that. It's there's a rich tradition in Southern food. It's extraordinarily complex.
The symbol of pop Southernization isn't a drink served in a mason jar, or even a plastic mason jar. The real metonym is the jar I saw at the farmer's market, a mass-produced jar that costs about $1, wrapped in $40 of accessories. But if I'm going to discuss authenticity here, I should be honest. I'm drinking out of a jar right now. As I record this, I have other glasses, but I like this one. My mom sent me jam in it. It feels right to drink from it, the same way it feels right to wear work boots or a chambray shirt to shop at the farmer's market, or to work in an office. And to be even more honest, I didn't just stumble into a place that was serving drinks out of mason jars. I was looking for it. I searched for mason jars on Yelp. It's not as easy to find as it once was. Jars have gone from a symbol of authenticity to parody. When something is mass manufactured out of plastic and sold in gas stations, it's harder to pass off as unique. You can't define yourself with something that's ubiquitous. And Kessler and Acheson both say they've seen jars fade too. I asked Kessler what's next. What will be the next way of consuming that goes from authentic to conspicuous?
You know, I'm sort of thinking that there might be like sort of a communal, you know, trough, and that people will just actually all get down on their hands and knees and drink their cocktails out of, you know, instead of actually buying a cocktail, you buy a certain period of time just to stick your face in it. I think that's kind of, I hear the places in New York that do that, so.
And maybe he was joking, but a few days later, I read in the paper that communal punch, served only to groups, is officially a thing.
That was Gabe Bullard, whose story about mason jars was featured on an episode of Gravy, a podcast that features stories about food and Southern food traditions. In a few minutes, we'll hear a story about why Jell-O, yes, Jell-O, was such an important food for many Appalachian housewives back in my grandparents' generation. Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Downcast, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. It's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the names of Appalachian places. Can you guess the town in Appalachia that got its name because hunters would store their meats in a cabin there? Is it Porky, Pennsylvania, Chicken Gizzard Ridge, Kentucky, or Meat Camp, North Carolina? We'll have the answer after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So, did you guess which town got its name because of the hunters that would store their meat there on long trips? If you guessed Meat Camp, North Carolina, you're right. We talked to Eric Plagg with the Watauga County Historical Society to tell us more about how Meat Camp got its name.
But what about the name Meat Camp? Well, that allegedly comes from a cabin that folks known as long hunters kept nearby, apparently as early as the 1760s, where they stored meat and hides during lengthy hunting trips. In time, that cabin became what Arthur calls a primitive packing house, where hunters likely dressed and cured their kills before heading out to continue hunting. Over time, the location became more famous for its nearby creek, Meat Camp Creek, which sported a substantially improved mill by 1840, including a carding machine. The meat storage business grew too, so that by the time of the Civil War, farmers frequently drove their livestock to Meat Camp to be sold or slaughtered before being sent to market. Other stories, including an account of Gilbert Norris in the Watauga Democrat in 1891, indicate a variation on this theme. Norris reported that the name came from hunters whose meat burned up in that cabin while they were hunting in the area.
If you have another story about Meat Camp or know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. Today we're hearing stories from a podcast called Gravy. We're also celebrating the one-year anniversary of our own occasional segment about food in our region, a series called Appetite Appalachia.
Corn, bread, and butter, beans, and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able.
This past year, we featured stories about restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots. We visited the Harvest Table restaurant in Virginia, traveled to a seed swap in Kentucky, and we've talked with mushroom farmers in Maryland and West Virginia. For our next story, Jell-O could seem like a trivial food. I mean, it's brightly colored, vibrantly orange, electric green, or unsettling blue. Nutritionally void, and hey, it jiggles. But in Appalachia, Jell-O marked a transformation in the lives of rural residents. In this episode of Gravy, what can Jell-O tell us about changes to life on the farm in the 1950s in Appalachia? Kentucky writer Laura Smith takes us to Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia to find out.
I've long believed in the alchemical properties of Jell-O. It's a powder made from ligament and bone. Add water, and all of a sudden you have a brightly colored jiggly solid. My fascination started as a child in the lunch line at the D&W cafeteria in Corbin, Kentucky. After snaking around the metal counter with my marbled plastic tray, I was electrified by the dessert case, a rainbow of perfectly cubed Jell-O, neatly portioned in parfait cups. Along with 7-Up, a cure-all tonic in my mother's house, Jell-O was a healing food, sustenance on a sick day home from school. After my second child was born, I discovered that along with the miracle of birth, there was a call button in the Lexington Hospital I could push on my bed that would bring a Jell-O delivery. I wore that button out. Each time a nurse appeared with a cup of red or orange Jell-O, I felt like a kid again. Last year, I heard from a friend that Jell-O was a food many women talked about in an oral history collection of mountain women at Berea College's archive. That got me curious.
Today is July 12, 2012, and we are here in St. Mary's, West Virginia, in the home of Miss Betty Bailey.
Today is May 24, 2012, and I'm in the home of Addie Mae Bicknell. Miss Bicknell has graciously agreed to be interviewed for this oral history research project titled Gathering the Stories of Appalachian Foodways.
The women in the collection were born in the 1930s and hailed from eastern Kentucky and West Virginia. These interviews tell us that families grew, put up, and cooked almost all of what they ate.
Down in the bottom, we had we raised some strawberries, and we planted our potatoes, and we had corn and green beans and tomatoes.
Meat was primarily chicken, pork, or wild game that they processed to store for winter.
Honey, oh yes, we loved to go hunting. And y'all never went when the moon was shining. You always went hunting when it was cloudy. Uh-huh. Dark out. Spooky.
Back then, a lot of people had apple orchards at home.
The women recall harvesting and foraging fruit. Apples, yes, but also plums, persimmons, and wild grapes. Desserts were usually reserved for special occasions.
And my mom would use different types of apples for different things to make. Like, she'd make the sour tart apples, she'd make apple butter and dry those for pies to make apple pies.
But Jell-O? I never thought of that as a particularly distinctive part of Appalachian cooking. And then I heard the interview with Mildred Arvin, who was born in 1943 in Drip Rock, Kentucky.
My mom, she'd buy Jell-O, and I know we would eat a lot of Jell-O. Everybody liked it, you know. Different.
Yeah.
Because we hadn't had that before.
They hadn't had Jell-O before.
One of the women that Katie Bills interviewed in West Virginia just kind of mentioned in passing, well, that was before Jell-O. And it was just sort of like a aha kind of moment.
That's Margaret Dotson. She teaches an Appalachian Foodways course at Berea College in Kentucky. Her students, Katie Bills and Courtney Bignall, conducted the oral histories now housed in special collections at Berea's Hutchins Library. She says the moment with Jell-O was a revelation.
We had never really thought about Jell-O as being a gauge for what people did in terms of cooking. And it really came down to, did they have electricity so they could have a refrigerator with a freezer, with the ice, the things you need to make Jell-O. And so for this woman, her whole cooking history, I guess, was before Jell-O and after Jell-O, which for me, that was a real kind of like, oh, I never thought of that before. But Jell-O became very, very popular after electricity came in.
And in our part of the U.S., that happened a lot later than most everywhere else.
There were parts of Appalachia that did not have electricity until the 1960s. And for a lot, it was the 1940s.
To appreciate the full impact of what Jell-O meant, we need to understand what life was like before it. Prior to electricity, families used traditional preserving methods to store food for slim winters. They cured hams, canned blackberries, strung beans to dry, and fermented cabbage for sauerkraut. Betty Bailey was born in 1937 in Clarksburg, West Virginia.
When I was a little girl, I remember Mother had the big stone jar that she put her sauerkraut down in. That one, and she'd cut that cabbage, and I thought that was the best stuff when you just put the salt on it, you know, after you'd fresh cut it. Oh my gosh, I'd almost make myself sick just eating that.
Addie Bignall was born in 1920 in Redlick, Kentucky. She remembers how her mother prepared apples with the sulfur smoking method to store for the winter months.
She put them in sacks, like cloth sacks, uh-huh. and put a stick across a barrel and hang a sack on each side and then cover it over. They'd stay so long till they get soft. And then she'd take them out and put them in fruit jars. I can almost taste them sulfured apples. They were good.
For food that had to be kept cold, like milk, families used caves, spring houses, and root cellars. Frances Davis was born in 1924 in Middle Island Creek, West Virginia. And that's how her grandmother did it.
She had a cave down around the hillside. And I was always afraid to go in that cave because I was afraid of snakes, because it built up out of stone, you know. Just a big stone cave is what it was. But she had shelves all around in there, and it was cold in there.
Despite her fears, Frances would be sent to the cave to get food for meals.
After we washed our hands good, we'd have to go down there and take that rock off, and then take that board off of there, and reach down in that old cold brine and get a handful of pickle beans. Or if we was getting sauerkraut, we'd have to do the same thing, to get a pan full of pickled kraut. Oh, I hated that. Stick my hands down in that old sour brine. Ugh. It was cold in the wintertime to do that.
In a world where reluctant little girls were sent down to a cave to fetch smelly, fermenting cabbage, imagine the wonder of a new refrigerator with shiny, futuristic Jell-O in it. Here's Margaret Dotson again.
Jell-O had been around since early part of the 1900s in the cities, but they had methods of getting ice or electricity to put the refrigerator and put the Jell-O in the refrigerator. So it was sort of like this, oh, now we're modern. Now we have electricity. Now we have a freezer. Now we have ice. Now we can make these Jell-O recipes.
We've been listening to a story about how electricity and Jell-O came to Appalachia and changed daily life for women on the farm. It's part of our occasional segment called Appetite Appalachia. On our website, you can revisit all of our Appetite Appalachia segments from the last year. That's at wvpublic.org. We'll pick back up with Laura Smith in this story in just a minute.
When my man goes to sea, he steps so high and free. I think I know as I watch him go that he has no need for me, for me. And when my man comes home and waits a while to roam, I think I see as he smiles at me that he's dreaming of the foam, the foam. I'm not a pious Christian, and I do not go to Mass, but I pray to Father Neptune to let him safely pass. I sing to the God with a three-pronged rod and the whiskers wild and free, but I've got a man with a beard and a tan and a passion for the sea. He rides through the foam, the cold and the warm, and he loves to risk his neck. And I'd like to know when he goes below that it's just below the deck. Oh, Neptune, Father Neptune, I'll tell you fair and true that if you should lose my sailor, I'll sing no more to you. When he's home from sea, he is half with me, and he's gone when I close the door. And it's still his creed that he has no need for a wife except on shore. I know it's a boat that keeps him afloat, but I like to think it's me. And if it were not for this, I would sink to the depths of the sea.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on our show, we're hearing stories about some interesting trends, both old and new, that you may know all about from your kitchen growing up. Now back to Laura Smith with her story about Jell-O's roots here in Appalachia.
The appearance of Jell-O in remote Appalachian kitchens was a direct result of rural families connecting to mainstream American culture through the very real connectivity of going on the grid. In 1935, President Franklin Roosevelt created the Rural Electrification Administration, that's the REA, as part of his New Deal policies. The goal? To bring electricity and telephone service to the nation's most rural areas. The program offered low interest and long-term loans to governments, farmer cooperatives, and nonprofits to run power lines to isolated areas. Power in the Land was a 1940 campaign film produced by the U.S. Film Service, the USDA, and the REA. It was directed by acclaimed Dutch documentary filmmaker Joris Ivens. A cinematic score and epic imagery of the American farming experience gave a window into the hard daily life of farmers.
It's good land here. Not prime, but good. Long settled land.
The film chronicles the daily life of the Parkinsons, a farm family living in Appalachian, Ohio, near the West Virginia border.
Bill Parkinson was born here in 1889, the year his father bought the farm.
On screen, Bill's wife, Hazel, appears outside near the farm's pump house. She's a thin woman wearing a short coat over her farm dress and apron. She vigorously works the hand pump, collecting water into a metal bucket.
Everybody has to help. If you marry a farmer, that's the first thing you learn. This is 1940, but the farm woman's day is long. They don't complain, the women like Hazel Parkinson, but they know on an August morning how hot the stove is going to be at noon. They may not say much about it, but they wish you could just turn a faucet to get your water the way you can in town. They know, and their children know, the work that goes into raising food for a nation.
The authoritative voiceover is intended to accomplish two things. First, to make the case to the American public for why this large public investment was needed.
Here on the farm, where it's needed most, electricity is hard to get. Power companies want a profit. They get it in the city where people are scrunched up together, but the farms are left in the dark. Three farms out of four are left in the dark. 75% of all farms in this big, inventive country. Seems wrong somehow.
And secondly, the film encouraged farmers to form cooperatives. They would then apply for government funding to bring electrical power lines to their hills and hollers. In short, it sought to convince them to trust the federal government.
Now they talk it over, the country way, the slow, cautious decision of the people. Electricity. About time we got around here. I'd sure like to light up the barn and the house, too. Power company won't do it. But I hear there's a new kind of power. Government. Well, now, how do you go about it? I ain't for it, but I'm ready to be convinced. Don't have to take it unless we want, but find out about it. Government power for our farms.
Kentucky was among the least electrified states at the start of the REA's work. Only 3% of the state's farms had electricity. Fewer than 10% of West Virginia farms were electrified. In the Berea Oral History Collection, most of the interviewees reported that their electricity came in the early 1950s. Betty Bailey remembered when her family got electricity in West Virginia.
Like I said, we did not have electricity on Cambridge until 1953. And must have moved there about 1940. So 13 years we lived on the ridge without electricity. We were only a mile from Route 16. And we were only there was another mile from our house to where the electricity came to, but they wouldn't build a line between those two places. Mm-hmm. And so we did not have electricity, and we had an ice box that we kept, and Mother canned meat, and we cured meat.
And what was the first change they made on the farm?
I remember in 1953 when we got electricity, the first thing my mother did was buy a refrigerator, of course, and then she bought an electric stove. Had the house wired so that she could have all those appliances. Well, In 1953, I was a sophomore in high school, and she bought a Hot Point refrigerator. Would you believe that that Hot Point refrigerator is in my garage right now and still running and keeping beverages cold for the kids? 60-some years later, that refrigerator is still going.
Refrigeration changed everything about household and farm labor, and the roles farm wives were expected to perform. Mountain women were no longer tied to wood stoves, canning massive quantities of produce. Now they could cut corn and freeze it. Instead of cooking beans outside over an open fire for hours, pressure canners could do it in 30 minutes on an electric stovetop. It also changed domestic aspirations.
Part of it was the modern kitchen, the modern woman.
That's Margaret Dotson again.
It was really a move, at least in my interpretation, it was kind of a move from blue-collar working. We can move up to be middle class. We can now have more fancy foods, more fancy desserts.
And there was no shortage of encouragement to join the rest of the country in celebrating the modern home cook.
There was all kinds of advertisements, and the whole cooking pamphlet thing from the early 1900s on really had a big impact on how women cooked. So if a company had a product, they had to provide recipes for people to try. And Jell-O was highly promoted in all the magazines, you know, from the early teens, the 20s, 30s. They would have these really quite artistic pictures of, look what you can put on your table, as opposed to the mashed potatoes or the biscuits or the cornbread.
Electricity meant rural women could join in this aspirational conversation about who we were as Americans by making quick and easy but impressive-looking Jell-O centerpieces for the table. Berea College's archives are also home to a collection of regional community cookbooks. Starting in the late 50s, many of the cookbooks start containing desserts with names like Wonder Salad that count everything from mayonnaise to chopped nuts to Coca-Cola as ingredients. Basically, if it was an ingredient in your kitchen, you could suspend it in a Jell-O mold and the ordinary became extraordinary.
Again, it was, we can now have what other people have. Now I've got the refrigeration, I can do it. So it was sort of like moving into middle America, midstream. Everyone else is there, we're not there yet, but we're getting there.
I live on a farm in the Kentucky County where some of the women in the collection were born. We're members of our local electric cooperative, but the talk around here is about a different set of lines making their way along the ridges. With federal dollars, some of the same cooperatives from the 30s are getting into the broadband business with the hope that high-speed internet will revolutionize our lives. Rural co-ops across the country are deciding to offer broadband in response to frustrations on farms, ranches, and in small towns where being unconnected hurts business. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, estimates 39% of America's rural population is without access to fixed broadband. For once, my corner of Kentucky is ahead of the nation. The chair of the FCC, Tom Wheeler, even came to our county a couple months ago for a press conference about what we're doing.
And I'm going to be talking about Jackson County and other places now. And so, my God, I've been in those hollers, and if they can do it, you can do it too.
Our county has some of the fastest fiber internet in the country, thanks to a local cooperative, and it's already made a big difference in my family's life. But for communities to the east of us, many homes are still on dial-up. I don't know how the future of rural Appalachia will change with the coming broadband expansion, and what, if any, changes it'll bring to women's work and the way we eat. Maybe future oral histories will be divided into before and after Pinterest. For now, the promise of a high-tech future and a more traditional mountain way of life coexist. The weather is warming up, and it's the beginning of another growing season. In the coming months, my Facebook feed will be filled with proud photos of my friends' marathon canning sessions and humble brags about their foraging hauls. But at my local Save-A-Lot, there's still shelf space dedicated to Jell-O, a reminder of the last time the future came knocking. Flavors like Jolly Rancher Blue Raspberry are hard to reconcile with the taste you'd find growing in the natural world around here. While I'm not willing to give up on my belief that Jell-O is magical, it's never been about the taste. It's about the memories I associate with it. For the farm women of Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, Jell-O was a marker in their lives for the convenience, modernity, and the changes in labor it represented. But what are the memories of taste that linger on their palates and minds? Those are reserved for the southern fruits of their childhood.
But fresh cherry pie was my favorite pie. Now, I'm not talking about cherry pie filling you buy in a can today. I'm talking about the fresh cherries picked off of the tree and made into pie. I still can taste that today, and I've never been able to duplicate it.
That was Betty Bailey from Clarksburg, West Virginia, on an episode of the podcast Gravy. Laura Smith helped to tell us about the history of Jell-O in Appalachia. Laura is co-founder of the Appalachian Food Summit and a beginning farmer who lives, writes, and occasionally makes a glamorous Jell-O salad in Egypt, Kentucky. This piece was originally written for the Southern Foodways Alliance magazine, also called Gravy. And speaking of gravy, my grandmother cooked homemade gravy and biscuits almost every morning. But the dish she had to have at Thanksgiving was pretzel salad. It's made with cream cheese, crushed pretzels, strawberries, and yep, strawberry Jell-O. She was a great cook and loved to do it. I don't have many of her recipes, but this episode has inspired me to at least try to get my family together to share their recipes. We don't see each other much these days. Granny would cook every Sunday after church. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the podcast Gravy, which is produced by the Southern Foodway Alliance. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Driftwood Soldier, Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Lache Swing and Weanland, Anna and Elizabeth, and Computer vs. Banjo for Diagram Collective. Gravy's theme music is by Wendell Patrick. Thanks also to Andy Agnew Jr., Ben Townsend, and Jake Sheps. Our Appetite Appalachia theme music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter @InAppalachia or @JessicaYLilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Streets, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.